welcoming to the show a legendary rock and roll performer, along with Paul Revere and the Raiders as the front man when they scored some 24 Billboard hits, 5 of them top 10 hits. Then a great solo career with big hits like Arizona, Silver Bird, and The Grass Won't Pay No Mind. He's gone on to do a number of things in the music world as an A&R man, and these days hosts a terrific show on Sirius XM Radio, Little Steven's Underground Garage. Every weekend you can hear Mark Lindsay's American Revolution. We are so happy to have Mark Lindsay with us here on Downtown. I'd like to go back to the beginning, not of time, but of your life and your career, if we could.
That's going to be a long interview if we go back that far.
Well, let's go back to about as far as Idaho. Growing up there, you're born in Oregon, raised in Idaho, and the story of you and Paul Revere getting together would be unbelievable if it weren't true that you guys go together like burgers and buns.
Here's what happened. I left home at 15. And went down to southern Idaho, to the Boise Valley area. Got a job at McClure's Bakery. And I met a guy who taught me a few chords on guitar. But right across the street from where he lived, which was near the College of Idaho, which means nothing to this interview. but he was kind of a country guy. He played a lot of Chet Atkins and stuff. But right across the street was a hamburger stand, and the little house next door where the owner lived. And the owner would go in, would have these practice sessions, and it was all rock and roll. And I thought, man, that's cool. If I could finally get in a band like that, now that would be cool. Well, one thing led to another, and I got a job with Freddie Chapman and the Idaho Playboys as being the rockabilly singer in the band. So I'm doing that on weekends and stuff, and that's all cool. But I still am yearning to be in an all rock band. So when I'm getting ahead of myself. So let me slow down and catch up here. So I'm working at McClure's Bakery, and I hear that there's a show, a concert down the street at the Elks Lodge, Elks Hall. So I go down there, I get all dressed up, and I've got my glasses on, but I take them off before I go in because I wouldn't look cool. I wanted to look cool. So I walk in, and I can't see anything. Everything, my vision was like 2600. It was like crazy. It was off the charts, literally off the charts. So, but I could hear a band playing off in the left-hand corner, far, at the far end of the building. So I kind of walked straight that way, and I just remembered the crowd kind of parting. It was like the Red Sea. It was like, I remember people got close enough to me, they looked at me like I was crazy. And I must have had a wild look in my eye, but I walked straight up or straight diagonally toward the stage and got to the stage. And they finished the song, and I asked him if I could sing a song. And the lead singer said, "Get out of here." But Revere, who was playing piano, and it was one of his first, he had just been hired as a piano player. And he said, "Well, sure, let him do it." He thought it might be, an amusement. If I was good, it was great. If I was bad, it would still work out, So I guess he says, "What do you want to sing?" I said, "Anything you want to play." He said, "Do you know You Win Again?" I said, "Sure, that old Hank Williams tune that Jerry Lee put on the flip side of one of his hit records."
Right.
And Rivers said, "Yeah, that one." So he said, "What key?" I said, "Any key." I didn't even know what a key was. And so they picked a key, probably G. And I got up and sang the song. And while I was singing, I was in heaven. It was incredible. It was wonderful. But then as soon as I finished, the world suddenly came back to me. And I realized that I was on stage I just finished singing a song, and that wasn't, you know, I was overcome with the shy kid that I really was. So I split and left hurriedly. The next day was Sunday. This was Saturday night. Next day was Sunday, and on Sunday, McClure's Bakery did not deliver buns. They didn't have their trucks out on Sunday. So Revere had to come down to the bakery to pick up his bun order for that day. And I'm kind of slow that morning because I got up late, probably. So Revere comes in, and while he's waiting for me to finish wrapping his order, he says, you know, we played right up the street here last night. I said, yeah. Yeah, in the middle of the show, the weirdest thing happened. This real skinny-looking kid with a wild look in his eye came up and demanded to sing a song. And I said, well, did you let him? He said, yeah. I said, well, how was he? And they said, you know, he wasn't bad. And I whipped out my glasses and my baker's hat. I said, it was me!
So you went from Clark Kent to Superman just taking off those glasses.
Kind of a reverse thing, absolutely. Except I didn't have the cape yet.
But oh my gosh! Well, anyway, you would get capes, you would get uniforms, you would get it all. Although you weren't the Raiders at first. You guys began as the Downbeats. How did you end up changing the name?
Well, first of all, the Downbeats happened. I was singing in the band. I was getting half of like if the band got, if every guy got $10, I got $5 because Revere explained to me, well, you don't do anything but sing. You don't play an instrument, so you don't get full pay. So I said, now if you played something like a sax, that's all he had to say. I went down and traded in a beautiful, probably 1930 Epiphone acoustic guitar for a new 1959 Summer Mark VI, and didn't even know how to hold it, so I decided to need some lessons. And there was a guy in town named Rennie who taught sax. He also taught music at the high school. So I went in. I had two lessons with him. I learned how to hold where to place my fingers on the notes. But on the second time I went, I looked down at his coffee table, and he had a copy of Downbeat magazine. I thought, Downbeat, that's a cool name for a band. I'm sure nobody's thought of that. So we were at the Downbeats for a little while, and then we got signed to, first of all, Tall Cool One came out by the Wailers, and it was a big hit in Idaho. And I told Revere, I said, look, man, these guys, I thought we're never going to be able to make a record because you got to be from Los Angeles or the East Coast or Chicago or somewhere to do that. You can't make a record in Idaho. But all of a sudden, a Tall Cool One came out. So I said, well, these guys are from they're from the Northwest. They're from Seattle. If they can make a record, we should be able to. So we found out that there was a great studio in Boise, IMN Productions, Intermountain Network Productions, where they did commercials for radio stations all over the Northwest. They had a great studio. They even had a three-track studio in 1960, which was more than state-of-the-art at that time. So we cut some demos. We went down to L.A., went first to Capitol Records, got thrown out, went to CBS, got thrown out. And he kept working his way down until he finally found this little record company. It was actually a subsidiary of a pressing plant down in Gardena. And the guy liked the stuff. So we all went down to L.A. to sign the contracts. And we didn't know much about Los Angeles. And instead of taking the freeway down to Gardena, we took Western Avenue all the way down, and took us about 2 hours to get there. We finally get there. We meet with John Gus, and he says, well, you got to sign these contracts and write your full name, and your age and all the good stuff. So we did, and he's looking at the contracts after we signed them. He says, And Revere at that time, it was only known as Paul Dick because he'd been teased unmercifully.
Right.
Still there?
Oh yeah, yeah.
When he was in school, Paul Revere, where's your horse? You know, so he he dropped the middle name and went as, you know, Paul Dick. He thought that was better than Paul Revere Dick. So John Gus says, you know, Down Beach is okay. That's cool, but. Now, Paul Revere, everybody knows Paul Revere. I mean, he was a hero of the American Revolution. You guys need to call yourself something like Paul Revere and the Night Riders, or Paul Revere, and he kept suggesting several things. And Revere said, no, 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 no. He had wanted nothing to do with Paul Revere. It was a big thorn in his side. So John says, well, okay, whatever you want. And, of course, when the record came out on the label, it said Paul Revere and the Night Riders. Well, I said, you know, Night Riders, that sounds like a cowboy, Western band. We should be Paul Revere and the something else. And that night I had a dream, and I saw us playing on stage, but we were playing on the stage of a pirate ship somehow. And we were swinging through the rigging and stuff. And I thought, you know, we were like Raiders. And I thought, wow, that's a cool name, Paul Revere and the Raiders. So we called John, and he reluctantly agreed to change the name to Paul Revere and the Raiders, and that's how the name became and stayed.
We're talking with Mark Lindsay here on Downtown. Now, it was your recording of Louie Louie that got the attention of CBS Records, and I think I'm right that you guys and the Kingsmen recorded it around the same time in the same studio. Now, is the legend true that it was Mitch Miller that did not want you guys to release Louie Louie as a single?
Well, Mitch Miller didn't want any rock and roll groups on his label. I mean, he hated rock and roll. He thought it was a passing fad, and if he just waited it out, you know, it would pass, and then he'd get back to the sing along with Mitch, and that was his thing. So we moved to Oregon. Revere has to, because Revere, it was draft time. Everyone was getting drafted for Vietnam if they were of an age. And Paul got drafted, except he was, his brothers, he had two brothers, and during World War II, they both signed up as conscientious objectors. His folks were more religious than he was. And so when Paul, it came time for him to sign up, he signed up just automatically as a CO. And to serve out his service, he had to find a hospital or a mental institution or something where he could serve out for 2 years as a cook or whatever mental, you know. He had to do something for his military service. So we moved to Oregon. He said, it's all over. I said, no, I'll go down to L.A. I'll keep on Paul on John Gus's butt so he doesn't forget about us. And then when you get out, we'll start the band again here. We'll find some more musicians and start here. So that's what happened. We became a hot band in the Portland area. There was another band in the Portland area called the Kingsmen who were supposedly our arch enemies. They weren't. They were friends of ours. And at our dances, people kept requesting this song called Louie Louie. We didn't have any idea what a Louie Louie was. So I was talking to Mike Mitchell, the guitar player from the Kingsmen. I said, do you know, have you heard a song called Louie Louie? He said, sure. He said, we play it 3 or 4 times a night. And I said, well, I've never heard of it. He said, well, look, I'll bring you the 45. So the next day, he came in with a copy of Rockin' Robin Roberts and the Wailers' version of Louie Louie, which was written by Richard Berry, of course. And we learned it. And it just so happened that our manager was a DJ. They had a manager who was also a DJ. But they somehow simultaneously got the idea to cut Louie Louie since it was such a popular song. So we were There's a giant argument. Paul always says we cut the song first. Always said, excuse me. Paul's no longer with us. And I don't know. I can't swear which one came first. All I remember is we cut Louie Louie, and on the flip side we cut Night Train, which was a sax instrumental, sax and guitar instrumental. And as I'm packing up my sax in the control room, the engineer said, if I were you guys, I would get Louie Louie out right away. And I said, why? He said, because the Kingsmen were in here a couple of days ago, and they cut a demo on Louie Louie. Well, what he thought was the demo was the finished master of Louie Louie, of the Kingsmen's Louie Louie. So, to my memory, they cut it first, but it was cut the same week, same studio, same engineer, same everything, same song, except we had the hit Up and Down the Coast. When the song first came out, both versions came out, they sold 600 copies in Portland. We sold 6,000.
Wow.
So we got the attention of CBS. One of the CBS promo guys came to, and he heard the song and heard the story. So he took it down to CBS in L.A., and about that time, people were leaning. Mitch Miller was the head of A&R for West Coast A&R for CBS Records at that time, and people were leaning on him to sign a rock and roll band because they said, you know, rock and roll is really happening. People are having big hits, selling a lot of records, and we're kind of getting lost in dust with Doris Day and and our old artists. So. So, reluctantly, Mitch signed us, but they did no promo for us, and we played Up and Down the Coast almost all the way to Los Angeles. We had San Francisco tied up. Of course, Seattle, and basically all the way down the coast, everywhere except L.A. We were just getting ready to break into L.A. when somebody from Scepter One Records heard about the competition and figured it out. So they went to one of the black stations in L.A., and they went to the program director and said, you know, it's really a shame how these white boys are trying to ace out our brothers from Louie Louie. And they didn't actually tell a lie, but they kind of left the impression that the Kingsmen were a black group. So... So the black station goes on Louie Louie in L.A. It becomes a huge hit, and we are left in the dust. And CBS kind of like forgets about us for a while. But we meet Terry Melcher, who becomes our producer. We find some records that we cut a few ourselves. We had no original material, so I started writing stuff. I wrote a song called Louie Go Home, which was kind of the answer, I thought, to Louie Louie.
Right.
And we, at that time, our repertoire was basically all black. I mean, the Kingsmen were supposed to be black, and we sounded black. we everything from was cut in New Orleans or wherever it was, we cut it. We added it to our repertoire, and if you listen to our version of "Louie Go Home," I definitely sounded fairly tan. I'll say.
Well, you scored. Fact,
"Louie Go Home" is probably, except for one other song, which I'll mention later. Louie Go Home was the most covered song that I ever wrote. It was covered by David Bowie, who was David Jones at the time, and The Who. But The Who, this is too long a story to tell today, but I'll tell a story. It doesn't make sense otherwise. I'm walking across the parking lot to a friend of ours, Terry Brown, who was Les Brown's daughter. Les Brown and his Brown Band of Renown. Mm. And she was a big R&B freak, and she loved our stuff because we sounded R&B. So she had a huge collection of records, and I'm walking across the parking lot about 6 in the morning, and I meet Pete Townsend coming out of her apartment complex. He's got this weird little device in his hand. I said, "What's that?" He said, "That's a cassette player, man. It's the latest thing. It's cool." He flips it over, shows me what. I said, you mean you can get a record on that?" He said, "I can get like several albums on that." I went, "Wow!" So he basically taped most of her record collection, but he didn't catalog anything. He didn't write down the names or the band, you know, anything, any information about the bands. So when Louis Go Home came out on a collection of records called Who's Missing, and they called it Louis Go Home, and they said, "We don't know who originally cut this, but you'll find, you know, you probably, if you look at the history of some old black artists, you'll probably find it." I'm paraphrasing, but something like that. You'll find the information in there. Well, when we found out that they'd covered the record, we immediately, our minions, like our publishing company, called them up and said, no, this is really a group that exists, and they headed out first, and we'd appreciate it if you'd stop, start sending our royalties to us instead of the boys. So, anyway, that was a little. I got sidetracked there.
That's all right. It's a great story. So I want to talk about where the action is. You'd had a big hit with Just Like Me. What brought you to the attention of Dick Clark?
The Stones were playing their first concert in the Los Angeles area. They were in a Long Beach auditorium, and it was the Stones with about 17 opening acts. I may be exaggerating, but not by much. It was what we were one of the opening acts. Caesar and Cleo was one of the opening acts. I can't remember the rest of them, but it was it was early in the day because Sonny and Cher were still billing themselves as Caesar and Cleo. I remember their act. They came out, and Cher was wearing this long skirt and all in Egyptian makeup. And somewhere halfway during the first number, she whips off her skirt. She said, in a short mini, I mean short, you can see her underwear. But and Sonny gets down on his knees and yells, "John, Paul, George, Ringo," and gets darted on giant screens from the audience. So I thought, well, that'll work for a while. Anyway, but one of the Clark secretaries happened to be in the audience, and she saw us, and we finished our we did like 3 or 4 songs. On the fourth song, it was probably Oop Oop Doo, and I'm dancing on the piano and screaming my lungs out. So she goes back to Dick and says, "Look, you know that pilot you're going to film for CBS, I think I've got a group for the pilot. They're from Idaho. They're going to work cheap, and they're very visual." So we got on the pilot along with Jan and Dean and the Four Seasons and the other luminaries. I'll slip out that way. And so we got signed to a 13-week contract. And Dick later told me, we were having lunch or something, he said, "You know, I signed you guys to 13 weeks because I thought that if the show took off, we'd be able to hire a real band."
Wow.
So I said, "Well, thanks a lot, but thank you, because the show, we became, we had like over 700 television appearances, network television appearances on that Daily Show and others, everything from the Johnny Carson to Smothers Brothers to, you know, whatever was happening, we were on it. And with all that television exposure, that helped sell records, as you probably know. And we suddenly became the hot band, and we were signed to a longer contract.
One of the great hits you had in that period was Kicks, written by Barry Mann and, of course, Cynthia Weil, who just passed away recently. That was such a great showcase for your vocal work.
Oh, thank you very much. It was Kicks, and then they followed up. They gave us a follow-up called Hungry, which I think is one of my best rock and roll performances. But they were both great rock and roll songs. And Cynthia was, I did a tribute to her on my non-terrestrial radio show on Sirius. I'm trying to get ahead of myself. I'm getting in my own way here.
Yeah, on American Revolution.
Yeah, on Little Stevens Underground Garage.
Right.
And I can't play anything. I can only play American music. I can't play anything that was English or Australian or anywhere else in the world. It's, you know, Little Steven calls me up and says, "Man, you used to have a radio show in Portland, didn't you?" I said, "Yeah, for a couple of years." So, "How would you like to be on the radio again?" This is just a little over a year ago. I said, "Well, I don't know. Why not?" He said, "Good, you're on." He'd be doing 2 hours on from 10 to 12 on Saturday and from 12 to 2 on Sunday. And I went, "Oh, okay." He said, "But it's American Revolution. You can't play anything that's not American music." I said, "Great." And that I forgot that I left out the Beatles and the Stones and a lot of people that came from England, you know. But we do okay. There's a lot of great music. Anyway, because Cynthia passed, we did a tribute show to Barry and Cynthia, or Cynthia, actually. And I had no idea how many songs that they actually wrote.
Yeah.
One of the songs, I'm not going to say which one, but I found one of the songs that I'm going to record on an album project that I'm working on right now, and it'll be the last Barry and Cynthia song that I ever get to do, because she's not there anymore. But she has just such a rich palette of music to choose from. I mean, You Lost That Love and Feeling. That was probably the most played song of the 20th century.
Yeah, and by the way, you and Susan Cousill did a great job on that.
Well, thank you very much. I thought when the idea of working with Susan came up, I thought we got to do Love and Feeling, because it always bothered me that these two guys are talking about never close your eyes anymore when I kiss your lips. I thought that's a little weird, boys. So I thought it was a boy-girl song. It should have been. So Susan and I did it, and I thought it came out good too. I mean, Susan's an incredible vocalist. She's top A number one.
Mark, I have to ask you. You mentioned the Rolling Stones. I've got to ask you about a story I heard years ago. Is it true that the Stones opened for you guys in Pittsburgh?
This is true, and the way it happened, we were supposed to be opening for the Stones, of course, but the radio show where the action is was so big in Pittsburgh, and we were so big in Pittsburgh because of it, that the promoter of the show, the promoter of the show said, you know, went to Mick and said, "You know, you guys are going to have to follow the Raiders." You guys are going to have to open for the Raiders. And Mick says, "Well, why? Who the F are these guys?" He said, "Well, they have a very hot TV show, and they're like hotter in Pittsburgh than you guys are. So you open for them." And Mick was feeling, but they did. And it was like, I think that happened one other time, but but it didn't happen many times after that, I promise you.
We're talking with Mark Lindsay on Downtown. You had a great run of solo hits and some terrific records. Kenny Young's Arizona, Silverbird, one of my favorites, and The Grass Won't Pay No Mind. And things were going pretty well. And then you ended up, oddly enough, having the biggest Raiders hit. But was Indian Reservation, was that originally going to be a Mark Lindsay solo record?
Yes, it was. Jack Gold, who Mitch had moved on to other things, and Jack Gold was now head of A&R, West Coast A&R, and he calls me in his office one day and says, "Mark, I've got your follow-up to Arizona." I said, "Great, play it for me." So he plays me a few bars of Indian Reservation. I said, "Wait a minute, I know this song. It was out by Don Farland." Don Farland.
Right, yeah.
I think so. A few months ago, and it sniffed. He said, "Well, it may have, but it's number one, top of the charts in England right now." And he said, "Aren't you part Cherokee Indian?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, I think you could really pull this one off. So we're going to do it." I said, "Well, okay." And I was very reluctant. But so we finally cut it, and I produced it. And Artie Butler did a great arrangement. And John DeAndre did the strings. And it came out really, really great, except at the end, it just ended. "Maybe someday when the film, but any nation will return." Bam. So Artie and I are listening to the playback after all the musicians had left, of course. I said, "Artie, this song just ends too abruptly. It needs some kind of coda. It needs something like, you know the song, Janis Ian's song, Society's Child?"
Right, yeah.
He says, "Yeah." He said, "Well," I said, "it needs a riff like that at the end. Does he mean like this?" And he said, "Plays it." I said, "Yeah, something like that." He said, we'll use that." I said, "No, we can't use that." He said, "Yes, you can." He said, "That was my session. I played the B3. That's my riff that I came up with. You want it on your record, you can have it." So we put it on there, and that's how it came on. And I think it was a perfect coda to the song.
Yeah.
And without it, who knows, Indian Reservation might not have been as big as it was. Sorry.
I was going to say, we had the great Hal Blaine on our show just about a year or so before he passed away. And Hal said he thought his drum work on Indian Reservation was some of the very best of his career.
The stars were aligned that day because when Hal arrived, he always got in early. He said, "Listen, Lindsay, look at this." And he had his drum set, which was, you know, not tremendously expansive. But on this one, he had, like, all these drums all the way around. I said, "What's this?" He said, "These are new drums I just got. I can play a whole octave now." So I said, "Well, that's cool." So the way Artie had arranged the chart, he had, like, a one-bar break at the end of the verse, and Hal did his thing, and it sounded great. And I stopped. I said, "Let's do another take. This time, Hal, do two bars there." Well, he just kept getting more and more till finally it was four bars, and he just filled up the whole thing with that signature drum lick he did, and that was one of the big selling points for that song, I think, also. Hal played on a lot of our stuff, and he was just an incredible drummer. He always had the right feel. He knew the right feel, and he always played it, and it always worked. And he'll be missed, I'll say that.
You stepped away from performing for a while. You were an A&R guy for United Artists, and you were instrumental in Kenny Rogers' huge comeback after the first edition. And you worked with Jerry Rafferty, right, on the Baker Street album? Or City to City, I think, was the album.
That was how I think I auditioned they gave me a copy of City to City, the Baker Street, which was Baker Street was on, and said, "We're thinking about picking up this album. Do you think there's any? Should we do this?" I said, "Well, let me take it home this weekend and listen to it." So I come back after the weekend. I said, "Yeah, you definitely pick this up." I said, "It's got at least three hits on it." I said, "Baker Street is going to be huge." They said, "Well, but it's like 8 minutes long." I said, "Well, hey, I can, you know, we can edit this down. It's got a great riff. It's going to be a smash. I predict, and don't ask me where these numbers came. I pulled them out of my ear, but I said, Baker Street, 3 million seller." And after that, right down the line, it'll sell. It's not as good a song as Baker Street, but it's a good song. It'll sell on impulse. It'll sell about 1.5 million. And then I picked one of the songs. Anyway, it came out that way. They all sold exactly those numbers. So I got the job. But don't ask me. Oh, one last addendum there. So it came out, but stations aren't playing it. And so I'm saying, well, Charlie Minor was our promo guy. And I said, "Charlie, why, you know?" He said, "Well, I get all kinds of excuses as to why they won't play." I said, "Listen, let me sit in your office with you tomorrow where you make all your calls." And so I did. And I wrote down, ask him why they're not playing it. So he did, and one station said, "Well, I like that lick, but it should be in the end as well." And it came up with, like, there was 11 different versions that radio stations wanted. So I went to my studio, and over the weekend, got my little razor blade and came back with 11 custom versions for the 11 big stations that wanted it or said they would play it if it was different, and said, "Here, send them these and ask them why they won't play it now." Well, they all went on it, and of course, after a few weeks, it all settled down to one version. But that's kind of how it got off the ground. So that was my big claim to fame at the label. Nothing else happened. I wanted to sign a lot of other artists, but they wouldn't let me. You know, and there's a whole other story that you're going to have to wait for my autobiography to read, because it's very deep. But there was a reason why they wouldn't let me do that, or sign anybody else. They were afraid that I might be right again.
Well, you've continued to make great music, and of course, I think you know our station is owned by Stephen King, and he had a rave review of your terrific recording with Los Straitjackets of "Tree to Right," the old Roy Head hit.
I read that, and I want to thank Stephen, and also tell him when you see him or when you hear from him that I'm really enjoying Fairy Tales. He hasn't lost his touch.
No, not at all. And your music is everywhere these days. Everybody has decided, look, we either need a Mark Lindsay solo record, or we need Paul Revere and the Raiders in our movie. And whether it's Quentin Tarantino or whether it's Licorice Pizza, it seems everywhere you turn, there are the Raiders. There's Mark Lindsay's incredible voice. It's got to be great that music is not only still out there, but finding new generations of fans.
Yeah, who would have thunk it, you know?
Well, those solo hits, Tony, we touched on them a little bit, but Silver Bird, man, that sounds as good as it did 50 years ago, Arizona. Just a great record. Now, did you produce those as well?
No, those were produced by Jerry Fuller.
Okay.
And he was supposed to produce Indian Reservation, but he and Clive Davis had a huge let's say how do I say this? They looked at things a lot differently, and so it turns out that Jerry could not produce any artists on CBS except Johnny Mathis, and he was not supposed to. He was basically forbidden to produce anybody. But Johnny heard about this and said, "Look, if Jerry can't produce me, I'm going to leave the label." And that scared CBS because Johnny had been there since the C had been put on CBS.
You've got some projects in the works, too, a documentary about where the action is and the music scene in L.A. in the 1960s. You've got a new release that you're planning on called Summer of Love. Can you talk a little bit about where those projects are and when we might get a chance to enjoy them?
Well, Summer of Love started out, I heard that Brian Wilson was looking for some material. A friend of mine and who worked with Brian also said that he was looking for some new songs. So I started writing songs for Brian Wilson, I thought. And so I demoed them out, a couple of them, and got them to him. And it turns out he said he really liked them, but he wanted to kind of like try to do some stuff himself, which, of course, he had never done before and never worked before. But so I thought, well, heck, I don't want to waste this stuff. It's really good. So I finished writing a whole album and put it in the can, and it became Summer of Love, and it's going to be out this summer, I think, even though we're about 60 years past the real Summer of Love or the first Summer of Love. But, you know, a good title always works.
Yeah, absolutely. Hey, do you still have your place in Maine?
No, pardon me. We lived, we had a farm, 50 acres, just outside of Lubec, and it was great. I mean, I loved it up there, but we were fixing up the farmhouse, and our electrician fell in love with the place, and he and his friend made us an offer we couldn't refuse, so we sold the farm, as they say.
Well, the weather is a little better down there, but you've got a little touch of the state of Maine. You've got a couple Maine coon cats still, right?
Sure do. And they started out just as little kittens, and now they're each probably about 15 pounds, and they're about half grown.
Wow.
They're going to be big. It's a boy and a girl. They're from the same litter, so they're twins, kind of. The girl is non-hearing, but that's okay because we had a kitty that before that was they couldn't hear. It didn't bother him at all. He was fearless. he couldn't hear the dog barking at him, so he didn't know he was supposed to run away. And she's kind of that way too. She's like fearless, basically. But they're great. They're great kids, and they give us a lot of pleasure, as they say. And every time we look at them, we think of Maine.
You can hear Mark, of course, every weekend. Mark Lindsay's American Revolution. That's on Little Stevens Underground Garage, Channel 21, Sirius XM Radio, Saturday mornings and Sunday afternoons. It's a great show, loaded with terrific music, and Mark doing what he does. Mark, it's great to talk with you. I've enjoyed your work for a long, long time, and it's wonderful to finally catch up with you.
Well, I appreciate it, Rich. And just one thing I would like to, if anybody wants to find out any more about the show or anything else that's going on, we urge them to go to marklindsay.com, where we have a deeper dive into the show every week. And like we have film clips of the artists that nobody's ever seen, and maybe they shouldn't. I'm not sure. But no, it's just a lot of fun. And it keeps, you know, I had no idea how much music I had never heard before until I started doing this show. It's amazing. And, we just had our first anniversary a couple of weeks ago. And little Steven said, "I can't believe it's been a year. Can you?" I said, "It has." And he's always doing, he's got a million things, a million projects in the works, and he's very ambitious, I'll say that, and very talented as
Absolutely.
Well.
That's awesome. Mark, thank you so much. Great talking with you. Appreciate you joining us today. Stay well, and we look forward to maybe talking with you again down the road.
Thank you, Rich.